Welcome to the T&D podcast brought to you by TomTom. We think you're trucking awesome. You deserve a trucking awesome app. That's why today we're excited to talk about the ultimate trucking companion, TomTom Go Navigation. With premium features designed to make every delivery a breeze, Go Navigation ensures you reach your destination efficiently and stress-free.
Hello, Matt Ireland once again here for the Truck and Driver podcast. And this will be part two of my conversation with Paul Rowlands. Hello, Paul.
Hello, mate boy. Welcome back.
Thank you very much.
You've got your coffee already?
Yeah, keen as mustard. So, quite an interesting sort of start to the tale last time. We got as far as Canada, I think, didn't we? So,
yes, we did. Yes.
So, well, we might as well pick the pace up and let you get on with it. Carrying on your tail. Yes.
Speed now. So, yeah, I'll have a bash.
Yeah.
Anyway, right. So, As Matt said, I'd sort of come back from Canada and with the intention of actually emigrating to Canada, because I was so excited by the idea of driving trucks over there. It's just a totally different environment.
Yeah.
Big country as well. Big country. So when I got back, it was popped down to Thorpe's, and as I walked into the office, "Oh, no, it's time then," said Keith. And I'd already asked about a job, and he said, yes, we can start you back. No problem. However, we've had to allocate the guy to another driver. Well, you see the smile on his face now. So all that's available is the old Atkinson. To say I was disappointed would be to put it mildly. Maybe I wasn't quite as important as I had led myself to believe. After the excitement of driving the vastness of Canada in the Freightliner, the Atkinson came up a poor second best. And I couldn't wait for my new Canadian passport to come through. But time dragged on, and the process seemed interminably slow. It was about this time that Bob Carter finally set himself up as a proper haulier. And on one of the occasions I was sent down for a load, he asked if I was interested in driving for him, as his ambition was still to do continental, I jumped at the chance. Even if it meant spending the first couple of months as company dock shunter, muscling a very heavy twin-steer Atkinson leader around the port. Not the ideal vehicle to manoeuvre in at tight spaces, I can tell you. Especially not without power steering. In October came the opportunity I'd been waiting for. A load of bricks was to be delivered to a project near Namur in Belgium. As I had a passport, was I interested? Even for a distance of around 125 miles into a foreign country, I was interested. However, as is life, or so it seemed to me at the time, as I still hadn't heard from the Canadian Embassy, 2 days before departure, the load was cancelled. Someone had undercut the price. Now, what a surprise. A week later, things were about to change. As firstly, whilst Bob had purchased a second-hand Volvo F88 and a half a dozen new Volvo F86s a few months previously, one of the 86s came up spare for me to drive. And secondly, talk about loads to the Middle East filled the air. Transport is full of rumour and chat, and, as most probably the majority of you have heard, there are more miles and adventures covered in a transport calf than there ever are out on the road. Well, there were when actual transport calves proliferated the highway of Britain. By early 75, my application to immigrate to Canada still hadn't come to fruition, and it was now 6 months since I had applied. It was at this time that Bob Carter confirmed that in a few months, the first trip to the Middle East would leave Felixstowe. Apparently, since the Arab-Israeli War of 73 and the setting up of OPEC, with its consequent push for a massive hike in oil prices, Middle Eastern countries were flush with cash and willing to buy anything and everything. And I do mean literally anything and everything. But it seemed that the small ports in the region were built to accommodate this vast influx of goods, with ships laying offshore for up to 3 or 4 months at a time before discharge. And it appeared that road transport was the only other feasible option. There was guaranteed work for those hauliers interested in trying their hand. This was not cafe talk anymore. This was going to be the genuine thing. In fact, there were hauliers such as Astran who were already involved in the transportation of goods to the Middle East. For the transport industry, it was almost their version of the 1849 American Gold Rush. Bob and his team had already started planning, but as he had only the one vehicle he thought suitable for that type of work, the F-88, and, as he knew there would be at least three or four loads going into the first trip, asked if any of his subcontractors were interested. One was Mitchell Rowlands, no relation, a local farmer, come low loader operator, who for a short time had become the distributor of imported Fiat lorries, and was interested in trying his luck. As Bob knew how desperate I was to do Continental, and as a guy called Lenny Balaam occupied the seat of F-88, he suggested I go and work for him until such time as the trip came to fruition. So, for the next 3 months, I drove a non-sleeper Fiat 619 for Mitchell Rowlands on container work out of Bob's yard down in Felixstowe. The difference between a non-sleeper 619 and any British equivalent was huge. For a start, with the seats pushed forward, it was possible to sleep behind them relatively comfortably. Secondly, it had a Bostrom suspension seats and was generally a much more comfortable environment to work in. And thirdly, with 240 horses under the cab, it was considerably more powerful than much of the transport on the road at the time. A top speed of 68 miles per hour wasn't to be sneered at either. As I commented earlier, big changes were taking place in the haulage industry, and the night out money that drivers used to expend on actual beds and digs was now being pocketed as extra cash by the influx of young drivers entering the business, as they made every effort to sleep in their non-sleeper cabs to save money, with all manner of bodge-ups proliferating British truck stops and service areas at night. Usually based around a cab-wide length of board resting on door window jams, with sleeping bag and pillow laying on top. Being young and a contortionist was essential in the confined space of a British manufactured lorry. The trade union, which during the era of BRS was a powerful force for structure, order and decent pay rates, were of course totally against the principle. And numerous companies that still retained strong union representation would not allow you to load in their compounds if sleeping equipment was spotted in your cab. Some would even have a representative on their company premises to check that you weren't carrying anything that remotely resembled bedding. The implementation of the O licence and the freedoms, and I put that in inverted commas as well, that supposedly offered the new breed of drivers, slowly wore down the strength of the union. And even though still known as the TGWU, Transport and General Workers Union, the majority of general haulage drivers eventually only joined because it was only union members that were allowed onto the docks. We are indeed a strange bunch as lorry drivers. We shout a lot about the industry's foibles, our poor driving conditions and lack of suitable parking, toilets and decent washing facilities, but resent the idea that as a joined up force, a lot more can be attained. Yet, then praise the French when they pull out all the stops and stand together. In the April of that year, after what seemed an interminable passage of time, things started to be pulled together. Bob had got an actual starting date for the first trip, 1st of June. So with a heightened level of excitement, I somehow managed to keep doing the Monday work of collecting and delivering containers while struggling to sleep at night with the thought of the unknown adventure laying ahead. A few days prior to departure, me and Lenny were given time off to sort out what we required for a four-week trip away. As I mentioned earlier, I wrote a book about my Middle East experiences, and it gives a much more detailed inventory of how it was than I can possibly tell here. But for me, this sort of travel was what I was born to. Adventure, excitement and work, all rolled into one. Boxes of mash, a suitcase full of baked beans, another of Spam, rice pudding, steamed treacle pudding, cartons of Lipton tea bags. These were going to be the staple of our diet for the next few weeks, as we hadn't the foggiest what to expect in the way of useful facilities once we'd left the known civilization of Western Europe. What we did know was that it was going to be hot, likely very hot, and a trip to Marks and Spencer's in Ipswich to top on shorts and t-shirts was organised. Well, it was my mother that did all the purchasing, as shopping wasn't really my forte. See, I was still a spoiled child living at home. An expensive new four-season sleeping bag costing £80, a small fortune back then, was going to provide all I needed in the way of warmth should the weather turn nasty. There were four of us that were going to make this maiden trip. Myself in a brand new sleeper 619 that my boss had purchased. Bob Crofton Slay, an owner-driver in his non-sleeper 619. Terry Blakesley in his brand new DAF 2800. And Lenny in the old Volvo F88. Terry, who had already completed a few trips, was going to show us the ropes, so to speak. As well as the four of us, Bob and Colin Staden from the office were going to accompany us in Bob's Humvee Scepter. according to Bob, not to interfere at all, but to get an understanding of what the job entailed and write up a reference manual for future trips. Looking back, a very enlightened way of approaching what could well be the making or breaking of his business. The 5 days between me and Lenny loading our rent coat trailers down in Middlesex and us lined up sitting outside the old Sunderland hangars at Felixstowe Dock passed in a daze. As I say, I struggled to sleep, overcome with excitement at the thought of the adventure we were about to face. It transpired that me and Lenny were off to Aberdan, down in the Persian Gulf, and Bob Crofton Slay and Terry were off to Terre Haute, where Bob Carter wanted to pursue some business interests. The frisson of excitement I felt as the ferry pulled away from the quayside was overwhelming. It was as if my life's ambition had finally been attained. Here I was, a 28-year-old young man off on the adventure of a lifetime into the Orient and beyond. This is what my mother had brought me into the world to do, not to sit at some boring desk dealing with people's income tax inquiries awaiting receipt of my pension. To go into detail about that first year would take up far too much time. What I can say is that it was all I expected and a lot, lot more. The old saying that travel broadens the mind is a factual statement, and I believe it to be one of the most important things anyone can do with their young lives. Go out and see what a wonderful world we live in. It's not all wine and roses, to be sure. But unless you get to compare the rough with the smooth, then living in one place your whole life will give you a very parochial and jaundiced view of our planet. On my return from that iconic first trip, I was more than disappointed to hear that it would be a couple of weeks at least until the next one was available. And Mike, my boss, having been very satisfied at the remuneration he received from that inaugural trip, decided he wasn't going to be patient and wait for the next one, and immediately fired me out to another contractor who sent me off to Greece with pea harvesters and bent Italian permits. Not that I knew of such a thing as a bent permit, until I was made infinitely aware by fingers at the Monsonese border crossing from France into Italy. An embarrassing incident followed, as I didn't understand the rules of the game. The customs officer, known as Fingers by all the regulars that passed this way, kept passing back my card until such time he waved me away and ordered me to the back of the queue. Sweating profusely with a mixture of embarrassment and naivety, another British driver wanted to know if my permit was genuine, asking to see it. On the green front copy, the words household removals were typed in. Certainly not pea harvesters. Right, mate, the other driver offered. This is Mickey Mouse. This is what's called a bent permit, as it doesn't cover the load you are carrying. It's the reason he won't accept your paperwork. You'll need to encourage him by slipping 10,000 lira inside and trying again. And that is what I did, handing my carnet through when I eventually reached the front of it. Everything went seamlessly from that point, and how he extracted the money I have no idea, but it certainly wasn't there when my paperwork was slid back through. It wasn't until later I realised that I'd been asked to transit via the Senice. Here in Ventimiglia were one of the few border crossings into Italy that were recognised as where tenners worth of cash would grease the wheels of commerce. For a few weeks I kept missing out on the Trans UK runs, as I was always away when another Middle East run left Felixstowe. Eventually I did make it back onto the long haul, and over the next few years I completed 28 trips to various destinations in the Middle East and was fortunate enough to experience much, from the harsh face and iron-fisted control of communism in the Eastern Bloc to the almost wild west, exuberant, anything goes, God willing, inshallah attitude of Turkey and the Orient. From extremes of weather that you wouldn't believe, such as temperatures down to minus 40 in the Turkish winters to plus 110 in the Iranian summer. From the breathtaking scenery of the Kurdish Anatolian mountains to the unforgiving heat of the deserts of Saudi Arabia. I have been fortunate enough to park my lorry alongside the Dead Sea and experience the effect that the extreme salinity has on one's ability to float, as well as visit the Grand Bazaar in Istanbul and to swim in the Aegean. The opportunities of adventure and to experience foreign cultures afforded to those who choose lorry driving, and especially long-haul driving as a career, are endless. Towards the end of my time as a Middle East driver, I was invited to partake in a radio chat show on what was then called Radio Warwell, fronted by a grizzled old presenter, Robbie Weston. A popular programme with locals, it dealt with the issues of the day, and in this evening's programme was the topic of road transport and juggernauts. A very emotive subject matter among the general public at the time, with the media, especially newspapers giving the road transport industry a torrid time of it. In reality, it wasn't the fault of the transport industry at all. It was due to the lack of investment in our road infrastructure and network that was the cause of many of the problems. There were three lorry drivers on the panel, one British-based driver, one who did continental, and myself who did ultra-long haul stuff. It was certainly a baptism of fire, as it wasn't many minutes before the general public were on the phone, queuing up to give us a verbal battering. We tried to deal with the criticism as best we could, but in reality, we were just three amateur panellists that had been asked to take part in a chat show. There was certainly some anger expressed over the airwaves, not only from the general public, from other drivers who were unhappy at the way certain restaurant chains, such as Little Chef, were buying up so many of the recognised transport cabs and then banning lorries from using them. I must admit that during this period of my driving career, I was very much that person on the other end of the phone, like the infamous Mr. Angry from Tunbridge Wells. I wrote numerous letters to the local newspapers complaining about our lot. Having married in 1977, by 1979, I thought it was only fair to my wife at the time to call it a day. I didn't want to leave the industry that I had come to love and applied for a position of allocator at a car transport company based at Volvo Concessionaires in Ipswich. That company was Tolman's, a name synonymous in the 1980s with Formula One, a young Ayrton Senna, and powerboat racing. Not that I was in any way involved in those high-profile events. My role was responsible for load building and ensuring that all the Volvo cars were delivered within the contractual agreement. 5 days for long distance, 3 for local. The fact that I was third choice for the position and therefore not thought to be the best available was a little disconcerting. However, once I settled into the job and proved myself, I came to really enjoy the responsibility of it. By the early 1980s, Tolman's had become the largest car delivery company in the country, running over 600 vehicles from 15 to 20 depots. At our own depot in Ipswich, in the time I had been there, we had grown from an original 26 car transporters to 51, plus utilising up to 60 to 80 subcontractors a week. My comment earlier about the fading power generally of the trade unions in no way related to their effect in this industry. Here was a scenario that belied the negative views of unions as portrayed by the newspapers of the time. A totally successful integrated operation whereby the management and union worked in, I won't say perfect harmony, but certainly an understanding of each other's aims and ambitions, which in turn provided the workforce with the best paying conditions of any in the transport industry at the time, while allowing the company to make excellent profits. Such was the understanding between management and unions that when the car market downturned badly in the late 80s, the union was persuaded to take a temporary 25% wage cut to enable the business to weather the storm. In 1981, my eldest son Lewis was born, and as my wife had to pack up work, I relinquished the position of allocator and applied for a vacancy driving a car transporter, as the wages were getting off at 50% higher than those in the office. Back on the road again after a break of nearly 4 years was quite refreshing, as even though I thoroughly enjoyed the different pressures entailed in providing our client Volvos with a successful delivery schedule, my heart was in the nuts and bolts of the job, driving. For the next few years, I ploughed my way up and down the country, delivering to all points of the UK, from the Volvo dealer in Thurso, right at the northern tip of the Scottish mainland, to Hale, not that far from Land's End, and from Haverford West on the Welsh west coast to Saxmundham in the east. We had a top-class workforce with an excellent camaraderie, often meeting up at regular haunts such as Penrith Truck Stop or the Boot and Shoe at Micklefield on the old A1. Over my 50 or so years in transport, I have been fortunate to have been in the employ of some marvellous companies, and although they have been disparate, very different types of jobs, I can honestly say that the terms, conditions and quality of life working for Tolman's was most probably the best. In 1986, the company quoted for a job outside their normal remit of delivering brand new cars to deliver 14 classic and vintage Ferraris and Bugattis to a Christie's run auction at the famous Lowe's Hotel in Monte Carlo. This was a brand new concept in the sale of classic cars, and unbeknown to us at the time, the forerunner of all the now famous classic car auctions that are so well known across the globe, such as the Paris Retromobile, Pebble Beach, California, Amelia Island, Florida, and the Concorso d'Eleganza, Villa d'Este, Lake Como, Italy. There were obviously sales of classic cars before this time, but not on this scale or at such an iconic venue. Previously, certainly in Europe, such prized vehicles would have been delivered for auction individually on a trailer, most probably pulled by a Land Rover or similar. Out of the 600 or so Thomann employees, I was one of four asked if I would be interested in driving one of the two transporters on the journey. Apparently my history of continental work and the fact that I could string two words of French together qualified me for the job. The four of us were going to double man the non-stop 800 or so mile run to Monaco. The other three lads were senior long-term employees of the company and had been offered the roles due to their importance to the smooth running of the business. Accompanying us in their Range Rover came the two Thomann twins, Gary and Michael, plus an employee of Christie's and a freelance motor journalist. Due to the value of the load, we were informed that the gendarmerie would be keeping a close eye on our progress across France to ensure no harm came to the drivers or their valuable cargo. Although I must say, it must have been a real covert operation, as not once in the 18 or so hour journey did I spot police of any kind. Back in the UK, it was almost front page news until something rather more important, which I sadly can't remember, blew us off the front pages. However, there was plenty of coverage inside the more market rags, and the strange, surreal reaction was a young lad on the Portsmouth Lyle ferry approaching us with his father's copy of the Times and asking us to sign a photograph for him. Fame, eh? Not even 2 minutes of that. Fortunately, the trip proved to be a huge success, with us arriving during the preparation of the Monaco Grand Prix and driving partway around the track before reversing into the hotel car park off the Lowe's corner. So pleased were our bosses that rather than require us to make the return journey after just a 10-hour break, we were offered the opportunity to spend a couple of nights in the actual hotel itself, boxroom-sized accommodation it might have been. And at £380 a night 40 years ago, roughly £1,100 in today's value, it was marvellous. But mixing it with a multimillionaire set was an experience not to be mixed. The whole auction fetched somewhere in the region of £8 million, a lot of money back then. Although with the way top-end classic car prices have gone since, it's not such a huge amount today. The most expensive car sold was one off my transporter, a 1956 Ferrari Testarossa 250 that went for £1 million and has since been sold again, this time for well over £30 million. Back home, things settled into the same old routine until a vacancy came up in early 1988 for a depot supervisor as my old mentor Alan Webb was retiring. At age 41, now with two young boys, I thought it was about time I grew up and spent more time at home, as on the transporter 3 nights out a week was quite normal. Against a little internal competition, I was offered the position and started on my third career with the company. The level of responsibility was perfect for me, and most importantly, it was a very hands-on position, responsible for a multitude of activities, generally ensuring the successful running of the depot yard activity. As Volvo's market share increased, so more parking space was required, which entailed the concessionaires renting out a new compound, known as Blowfield Road, on the perimeter of the port. A large yard that became better known as Russell Davis's Container Operation Base once we had vacated the premises in the late 1990. From a car movement perspective, this new site came under my jurisdiction, requiring extra staff. We also had a railhead in Ipswich, where we experimented with railing cars to various conurbations across the country, but soon had to give that option up, as there was an inordinate amount of damage and delay compared to the use of car transporters. Apparently, kids like to throw rocks from bridges, although personally, I believe it was more to do with the Volvo's annoyance at the amount of time some of the cars stood in on rail carriages in sidings before final delivery, but paid to that trial. Sadly, 1992 was not a good year, as my 15-year marriage came to an abrupt finish, and the beginning of the end was also nigh work-wise, as rumours spread that Volvo concessionaires were looking at other venues to import cars. Our rolling 5-year contract was up for renewal in the next few months, and by this time, myself, Alan Day, a work colleague, had been asked to work out of our Southampton depot, where the new Volvo 440s were being imported by a company called CAT. Our role was to perform as a mini depot, checking the PDI, pre-delivery inspection, work of the Renault technicians, who had been given the responsibility of performing that task, before we organised their onward delivery. For a number of months at weekends, we commuted backwards and forwards in a company transit van, while space for the hotel for the actual working week. In the June of 93, I was posted up to Leith Dock to supervise the influx of the Ford Sierra replacement, the brand new Ford Mondeo. 30 years ago, vehicle registration changes came once a year, for August 1st, and the pressure to get cars into the country and ready for that date was intense, as customers wanted to show off their new updated letter prefix, which in 1993 was M. Ford, by far the largest importer of cars into the UK, utilised any available port that could accept a large car ferry. And numerous of us minions were sent scuttling off to various small ports around the country to do our boss's bidding. For me, that meant making my way to Stansted Airport early on Monday morning and commuting to Edinburgh Airport. A week spent organising the arrival, checking and delivery of hundreds of cars, and Friday afternoon I was back on the plane heading for Stansted. It became such a normal function for the next 8 weeks that it felt no different to catching a bus to work. No passport required. A baggage check and take your seat for the hour-long flight. Another hotel was my accommodation for the duration. There was one light moment that stuck with me, and that was when, on return after virtually my last flight, I arrived at Stansted to be greeted by a placard with my name on. As part of the arrangement was the use of a hire car to transport me to and from my home to the airport. The poor chap, who obviously worked for the hire company, was full of enthusiasm for the fact that he'd got me a brand new Ford Mondeo for the weekend, fully expecting me to be over the moon that I'd got a car that had only been released to the public the previous day. The look of disappointment on his face when I explained that for the past few weeks all I'd seen and had nightmares about were bloody Ford Mondeos seemed to rather deflate him. From here, me and Alan were once again put in harness together, transferred to Dolman's Brentwood HQ, and installed in a small office up on the director's floor, a slightly higher floor than our menial status demanded. But as we'd been seconded to one of the directors, this was to be our home for the next few months. Our remit was to research how the industry had come to the situation whereby nearly 50% of the new car registrations ended up around the change of letter, and how we could somehow mitigate the huge extra cost incurred due to the need to find extra storage space for the hundreds of thousands of cars arriving during the pre-August rush. 3 months of analysis and a couple of trips across to Antwerp, where the cars were ferried from, allowed us to present graphs, stats and a spreadsheet as to how this could be ameliorated. Handing over our evidence to the board, Alan decided that there was no future in our Ipswich depot to take a voluntary redundancy package, while I was asked to deliver Tolman's new contract offer to Volvo HQ in Marlow, and informed that should the offer be accepted, then I would be given the opportunity to manage the new depot, which they were proposing to set up in Tilbury. Sadly, Volvo had decided they were going down a different path, and Tolman's weren't invited to play any part in it. For a good 18 months, I had not set foot in the Ipswich depot, and I was now offered the role as ops manager of a brand new concept, also set up in Tilbury, this time to run the transport operation of a second-hand, low-mileage ex-company car scheme, vetted to 100 points by AA technicians, and guaranteed to not have exceeded 6,000 miles. They were then to be fed back into a slightly more salubrious version of the second-hand car market. By this time, I was developing a relationship with a new partner, Francis, and the long days and constant commitment to Tilbury from Ipswich weren't exactly beneficial to that. So after a total of 23 months where I was only home at weekends, I also took a redundancy package and spent a few months on sabbatical from any work at all. At the start of 94, I applied for and took a job running the transport desk of an employment agency, and the least said about that, the better. Salary was third world in quantity, but with the promise of excellent bonuses as the targets were achieved. All well and good, as I reached the target and received the bonus, only to find that having attained that figure, the target was then increased, with the proviso that if it wasn't breached, I would be back on my basic income. An absolute pittance. On reaching the second target, a further increased bonus was paid, but an even higher figure was set for the following month. Failing to reach the higher figure of drivers provided to clients meant I didn't reach the target and was reduced to basic salary, and I immediately offered my resignation. I mean, I don't mind a fair fight to earn a living, but their scheme was beyond a joke.
You're listening to the Truck and Driver podcast brought to you by TomTom. The TomTom Go navigation offers a specific set of truck features. You can set your cargo and truck dimensions for specific routes so you can drive confidently on suitable roads, making every journey efficient and reliable. Truck, yeah.
During my short sojourn at the agency, I'd come into contact with a certain Fred Archer, a man I had met during my time on the Middle East brand many years previously. And he was looking for a driver on his renamed company, Ultra Hall European. Back on the road again, initially in a well-used DAF 95-385. It was a regular run across the newly amalgamated East and West Germany to the Polish border at Sweco. As yet, Poland hadn't become a member of the EU, although it was making preliminary moves in that direction. The border crossing on the far side of the River Oder was unusual in that it was basically an old railway station where the railway lines removed and the buildings on the three remaining platforms used as the customs offices. Drawing up alongside one of these platforms like a train might and stepping out onto it was a really bizarre sensation. The roads, as were the roads of communist bloc countries 20 years previously in the 1970s, as diabolical as ever, pitted and potholed enough to require a high level of care when driving. You know all about these roads, Matt.
I do, Russia.
And what have you. and so in the 50 years, I mean, I know now when the last time I was in Russia was seven years ago, and they were starting to improve. But when you were going across there in the 90s, were you?
No, not later. No. The first time I went to Poland was 2007, I think it was. And even then, that's before they put all the new motorway in for the, was it the World Cup or the new...
Oh, right, you had motorway to Warsaw. You had motorway to Warsaw, did you?
No, there wasn't motorway to Warsaw. Oh, yeah, no, the first time I went further south, in going to Katowice.
Okay.
But even then, the ruts were just... a league of their own. You can let go of the steering wheel and just let it.
Funny enough, I've got a comment about that here now. The road, as I said, the roads, as were the roads of Commons Block 20 years previously in the 70s, as diabolical as ever, pitted and potholed enough to require a high level of care when driving. In fact, the Poznan Ring Road was so bad and the tarmac tram line so deep that the only way to transit the city was to ensure your wheels sat in them as the traffic followed each other around in single file. Absolutely horrendous. The enthusiasm of these old communist-controlled countries to take on board the trappings of the good old West was no more highlighted than when I drove past the first McDonald's in the country the day it opened on the outskirts of Warsaw and couldn't believe the length of the queue wait to save their cordon bleu offerings. About 6 months or so later, Fred offered me one of the three brand-new Scania 113 top lines he had purchased, and within weeks I was regularly tramping up and down to Sifty Bertie's depot at Leinarty, north of Milan. These were good times again, an era still before modern technology had really taken a hold. Although by now Fred had installed cab phones, although they weren't much use once behind the old iron curtain, the most memorable trip for me was during this time was a load of medicinal stuff for the UNHCR to Belgrade, with a reload of date-expired stuff from Sabak, one of their compounds 60 miles southwest down towards the war zone. To say I was a little concerned at this request would be putting it mildly. This was during the Balkan conflict, and Serbia most probably wasn't the safest place to be. Fred ensured me that when I arrived at the Tompa border, I should phone a chap called Milos in Belgrade, and anyway, there would probably likely be a UN convoy heading to the capital, so not to worry. Ha! As much as I like Fred, that statement was just a load of words. Off I went, arriving at Tompa just over 3 days later. I'd already tried to phone this Milos guy from Szeged in Hungary, with no joy. It was night time and a miserable, dank, drizzly evening as I arrived at the back of a long queue of cars parked haphazardly either side of the road. I certainly wasn't waiting there, and with a few choice words to car drivers that were virtually blocking the road, squeezed my way past all the old Yugos, Zastavas and Trabants until I eventually pulled up beside a couple of Czech CSAD lorries at the actual frontier. Walking into the customs office on the Hungarian side, I found myself behind one of the drivers, and after a bit of a chat with my limited German, he asked where I was off to. Telling him Beograd, he shook his head and said, "Beograd, nix gut. Große Probleme, Kollege." A pretty much self-explanatory comment designed to make me feel really good about my chances. It was late evening, and dark as hell as the barrier was lifted, and I was allowed through into no man's land. It used to be no more than 200 yards to the old Yugoslav border post, but now all I could see from the beam of my headlights was rain and pitch blackness all around. What an eerie experience, as I drove on slowly, unsure as to what to expect. I'd driven for about 3 kilometres when around a turn I could see in the distance a whole battery of very powerful arc lights. approaching the barrier, which was absolutely massive and reminded me of the one between West Germany and Czechoslovakia all those years ago at White House. It was swung open horizontally while a couple of guys in combats waved me down with their Kalashnikovs. One of them barked, "Coming control!" I can't say I was frightened, but there was certainly an air of menace. This was not like anything I'd dealt with before. There was a sense of, I don't know, something inexplicable. A sort of organised chaos where people were ready for something bad to happen. I felt very uncomfortable and ill at ease. Their search of a cab soon turned up my camera, and without a by your leave, it was confiscated, never to be seen again. "Name a photograph! Name a photograph!" one of them yelled at me. "No photographs. No photographs." A couple of the guards jumped up either side of the cab and directed me to a parking spot near an office block. One of them, putting up a hand, instructed me to stay in the cab. The whole area was lit by massive stadium lights, and there were people busy everywhere, mostly in combat and all carrying guns. My bright red Scania certainly looked out of place among the dreary-looking Tams I was parked alongside. 10 minutes passed before a couple of soldiers came to escort me to an office, where I was told to sit at a desk and wait. Another 5 minutes, and an officer of some such person of authority came and sat opposite me. He spoke reasonable English, but with a Slavic accent. "Your papers, colleague? What is it?" "Medical supplies for the UNHCR," I replied. "Huh? United Nations no good. Big problem here in Serbia." He spent 10 minutes leafing through my paperwork before asking if I had any drugs. I shook my head vigorously. "Good. Serbia drugs very bad. Prison. Maybe shoot." "Okay. Have you a special visa?" "Okay. Have you a special Serbia permit?" "Okay, you must change money for dinars, okay?" Oh, great. Fred had given me £300 running money and hadn't informed me of any of this. "Par for the course, really. You'll manage, boy," would be his response. "I must speak with this man, please," indicating the name of the contact I should call. "Yes, yes, yes. It's not a problem. First, you must have permit and visa. It's new law in Serbia." "How much?" I asked resignedly. "It's no much, Dina. Now you sleep. In morning, speak with chef and pay in dollar." A soldier escorted me back to my cab, but I had very little sleep, as even with the curtains closed, the lights were too powerful. I suppose I must have slept a bit, because I was awoken with a bang on the door at 8 a.m. and told to get ready to see the chef. I noticed that the two CSAD wagons had come through during the night, as they were parked next to me. I was escorted back to the office by the two guys in normal clothing, but still sporting the ubiquitous Kalashnikovs. The chef waved me to sit down as he continued talking on the phone. As I was waiting, the officer from last night came in. Apparently he was going to translate. "Good morning, colleague. Passport, please." I handed it over. "How you say this name?" "Roland," I replied. "Okay, Mr. Rolands. You must pay for visa Serbia for $300 and for permit $250, and you must change to dinar for $200, okay?" The chef, who up till now still hadn't commented, spoke to the officer, who turned to me and asked, "Chef wants to know, have you been Serbia before?" I told him I used to travel through the old Yugoslavia 18 years previously, when Tito was president. And the chef seemed impressed, obviously a Tito man, as he nodded when I mentioned the name. "Have you dollars?" asked the officer. "Only £200, I lied. He tallied it up on an ancient hand-cranked calculator. "It's only $300. You must pay $750. "Do you have bank machine?" I asked, thinking it was highly unlikely that it did. "Mr. Rollins, this is not possible. You cannot come Serbia without pay." "Can I phone this number?" I asked, pointing to the contact name again. A conversation took place between them before a nod of the head. "Okay, we will speak for you." 10 minutes later, I was talking to my agent Milos in Belgrade, and he said he would bring cash to the border and sort out any problems when he got here in about 3 hours. Good to his word, at 1 p.m. he was discussing terms with the officers. Not sure $750 exchanged hands, but within half an hour, I had my visa and permit and was ready to roll. "I thought there was supposed to be a convoy," I said to Milos. "Who told you that?" he responded. "There are only convoys in war zones." good old Fred, say anything to keep me quiet. What you must do is stay close to me, explained Milos, because the people are not happy about UN sanctions. There is a very little fuel in the country. I followed him in his Zastava down to Novi Sad without too many problems. But from there on, it got a little more hairy. As the closer we got to Belgrade, more and more people lined the side of the road, waving all sorts of bottles and canisters, desperate for a few litres of fuel. Unbelievably, he took me to the National Hotel. But not the National Hotel I fondly remembered from all those years ago. The place was packed with wrecked vehicles and looked more like a scrapyard than a hotel car park. And all the Georges had gone. For those of you who don't know, back in the day, the hotel was manned by male members of staff that were all known as George. At the moment, the hotel was closed for business. You must wait here for 2 hours, instructed Milos. I will leave my friend to look after you. I must make arrangements for customs clearance. It was a long 2 hours before he returned, as his friend spoke no English. Now we must go to the customs, which is at the airport, where you must wait. Maybe one day, then I will collect you and we will unload. I followed him to the airport and found somewhere to park. I don't know whether or not you have seen the film Mad Max, but if I said it looked like a scene from that film, I wouldn't be exaggerating. Even though there was security on the buckled gates, people were wandering in and out as if it was market day. The place certainly wasn't a thriving international airport anymore. It was more akin to a huge scrapyard, with burnt out vehicles and huge piles of detritus laying around in an indescribable mess. Meanwhile, hawkers were trying to sell their rubbish amongst this chaos. Most of the trucks were driverless, and their diesel tanks looked as if they had been ransacked. It seemed as even though many drivers had fitted locks to their fuel caps, thieves had just drilled in from the top and siphoned the contents out. There were literally dozens of trucks with gaping holes in the top of their tanks. Those drivers who had trucks were sticking to them like glue. In the West, we often hear that sanctions have been applied to this or that terrorist state without realising what it means in practice. Well, here in Belgrade, I could see firsthand the effect it was having. This is not a good place, said Milos. I will get a guard for you tonight. And he sent off his colleague to sort it out. 10 minutes later, he returned with what I could only sum up as a tramp. It's the best way I could describe him. But he had a gun. It turns out he was a veritable one-man army, because he had 3 guns and 2 very large knives, and apparently knew how to use them. Myla said he would return about midday tomorrow, and not to worry, as this was a good man who had been in the Special Army. He didn't speak one solitary word to me and to Myla until Myla's returned the following day. But I slept reasonably well, and when I awoke, he was still sitting outside the camp. By mid-afternoon, I was unloaded in Sam Backstreet establishment and ready to head to Sabak. I was certainly very nervous, having to head down closer to the war zone. But as it transpired, nothing untoward happened. I managed to return safely from this expedition, but when Fred asked a few weeks later would I be happy to do a second run, I declined, especially when he said he thought there would be a convoy. It wasn't because I was frightened, more apprehensive. Even though I was 30 to 40 miles from the actual war zone, I still felt uneasy. Countries involved in violent warfare have a feel about them, and life is certainly cheaper when you're in the vicinity. During my time at the employment agency, I also reacquainted myself with an old mate, Peter, who just happened to be the transport manager at James Campbell, and it transpired they were in the market for a shunter driver. They only ran a fleet of 14 units and 20 trailers, and to give him his due, the owner, Charles Reed, always ran an efficient and tidy ship. I could often be seen outside in the yard greasing the mechanism on the slider trailers. Working back at Felixstowe meant my life became a little more structured. Excitement and adventure were strictly limited to collecting containers from either 72 Park or Trinity Terminal. Charles was chair of the road transport group of hauliers that operated out of the dock and was a very well thought of individual. For a couple of years, things settled into a steady daily routine as I tipped and loaded trailers into our Dooley Road compound. Quite a bit of the work was for K-Line, and one day I was called into the office to ask if I would be interested in learning to drive a Boss container forklift. Basically an extremely large forklift capable of lifting empty 20 and 40 foot containers. I had to take the relevant forklift license, and as recognition of the fact, I would be upgraded to depot foreman, responsible for all yard activities. I came to love the job again. As yet, again, it was very hands-on and required practical skills. My wife, Fran, would say it was the sort of job that suited my personality, driving and organising people. What she actually said was, "You're so bossy and love telling people what to do." What Charles had managed to do was acquire K-Line's storage and service facility for their container operation, which meant transferring to a much larger yard, this time in Hodgkinson Road. By this time, Kembles was running a fleet of getting on for 30 trucks and was regarded as a very successful operation. My role allowed me to take the blank canvas of a large tarmac yard and, with Charles' approval, helped turn it into a viable container storage facility, setting up a repair and cleansing operation to supplement the work of storage. The job also had the added bonus of keeping me very fit, as the number of times I was up and down the 14 container lift steps in a day assessing containers was beyond number. I really enjoyed the process of seeing James Kendall model develop, and when I chose to leave the operation in 1999, part of me was very sad to go. But I was not drifting far from my beloved steering wheel, just a major downsizing in vehicle size, as I purchased my own car to become a taxi driver for M&R Cars at Woodbridge and Suffolk. Just to say, as it's not really haulage related, that I enjoyed the 8-year experience, especially the Friday and Saturday late night shifts. How normally well-behaved young ladies and gentlemen can have such massive personality changes after a night out partying is beyond belief. Personal decorum just goes out of the window. A real eye-opener for such an innocent as myself. The other highlight was the opportunity to have as a passenger the odd celebrity, such as Brian Blessed and Tim Rice, who when in your car turn out to be just as normal as oneself, other than their slightly larger bank balance, of course. The start of 2007 sees me taking the jump into proper self-employment, as I set up a business offering a different type of taxi service, this time aimed at the middle classes. Registered as In Your Car, the title might sound pretty self-explanatory, and it delivered what it said on the tin: a service offered to those with more important things to do with their lives than drive. My business model allowed me to drive the customer in their car to whatever destination they wished. Interestingly, it was most probably the only enterprise of its kind in the UK, as none of the insurance companies I contacted, and there were many dozens, could offer a policy that would cover me for this type of work. Finally, a neighbour who worked in the financial industry put me in touch with an actual Lloyd's broker in London who laid policies. This guy had the loads of money Harry Enfield persona to a T. Red braces, Porsche, holiday in the Maldives, the lot, but at least took a chance on me. For the princely sum of £2,500, I was allowed to drive any customer's car to a value of £100,000, which 25 years ago pretty much covered the value of most cars on the road. 20 years ago. I appreciate this is still not road haulage, as most would like to hear, but for me it was still driving, and at the age of 60, I was totally confident in my ability to deliver clients safely and stress-free to their destination. For such passengers as these, sitting in the rear of their cars while conducting important business on their laptops or on the phone, stress-free is critical. Not only do they not want any damage done to their car, but nor do they want to be looking out of the window every few seconds to check whether you're driving too close to the vehicle in front. I absolutely loved the opportunity, and within a year was on occasion employing 4 or 5 other drivers a day. Requirements were totally varied, from run-of-the-mill airport jobs to a long-distance funeral run to Manchester, where the husband didn't want to attend, but the wife did. Business trips to Edinburgh, and even an invite to the village of Port Merion for a weekend to celebrate a client's 40th birthday, as long as I ran taxi service from Manchester Airport to Port Merion for his guests flying in from all over the world. Sadly, the financial crash the following year, 2008, put an end to this foray into self-employment, as the first things to go in times of financial difficulty are what are known as luxury industries. I was amazed at how rapidly the phone stopped ringing, and before anyone comments, no, it wasn't anything to do with the service I offered. It was solely the costs. I did manage to retain a couple of very wealthy customers, but the writing was on the wall, and I didn't have the financial wherewithal to ride out the storm. I don't know that I've ever been depressed, but for a short period I was certainly not at my best, as emotionally I'd invested a lot into my budding business enterprise. I was almost in panic mode as to what to do. By now I am 62, and theoretically due to retire in 3 years' time. Who is going to employ an old fart nearing his dotage? Well, that was my view of my employment potential anyway. Interestingly, I read somewhere that when things are at their worst, write down your life experiences. And after meeting up with my son Lewis's friend Matt Ireland, there we are, Matt.
Hello.
Who's interviewing who here? An enthusiastic follower of Middle East folklore, that is what I decided to do. And over the next 2 years, managed to put together a manuscript full of my mostly driving experiences and get them to publication. 14 years later, it's still for sale. Just a little plug. At the time, Matt and my son were both driving for a company called Trans Am on the rock and roll circuit, and young Matt suggested I give him a call. His supportive comment was that there are plenty of other old farts working there as it is. One more won't make a difference. So I made the call, and after giving them my background, I was invited up for an interview. Initially, I was given jobs that bore no direct relation to the R&R scene, such as collecting new trailers and general dog's bodies work, presumably to check on my reliability, because make no bones about it, reliability is the key to success of this type of work. But at least it kept the wolf from the door. Then, out of the blue, someone fell ill on the Dancing on Ice tour, and with 12 hours notice, I was asked to cover a fortnight's work. This was 2009. Having not driven a left hooker for a number of years, in fact, not having driven any commercial vehicle for 10 years, I was more than a little apprehensive. But fortunately, things turned out okay, as I arrived up at the NIA arena in Birmingham without incident. To say I felt a square peg in a round hole would be putting it mildly. Here I was, a man of 62 years of age with a huge history in the transport industry, supposedly at the end of his career, suddenly have to face up to the fact that here I was a new boy with zero previous experience, but certainly not in this manic industry. The two bits of advice I was given were, don't try and socialise with the performers. These are people doing a job, a bit like yourself, who don't want to be bothered by Star Trek lorry drivers. And always be ready for load out and load in. Sackable offences if you're not. And it's not funny being sacked when you're 1,000 miles from home with a cab full of stuff you've got to empty. There's no forgiveness. Let the side down and it's instant dismissal, regardless. In fact, when you become an established tour driver, you come to realise that these superstars are human, just like the rest of us. And on the odd occasion, maybe when outside the rear of an arena having a smoke, they might well instigate a conversation. Trans Am must have been reasonably satisfied with my performance, as after the tour finished, and a few more weeks doing the mundane work all successful companies have to do in support of their main operation, including a trip to Belgium, collecting equipment for an upcoming U2 tour. That's when I met you, I think.
Yep, we're out on that.
Yeah, I was offered 7 weeks' work on the British leg of the Walking Dinosaurs gig. The complete European tour was going to take virtually a full year, but as newbies, the majority of us were informed that once it left for Europe, more senior drivers would take our place. I didn't care. 7 weeks' work, paid 7 days a week, was a godsend. It may not be rock and roll, but as an innocent in these matters, theatrical tours were just as glamorous as long as they paid the bills. There were 11 of us, shunting 22 trailers between the various UK cities. Each gig lasted 5 days, with two allowed for moving. I loved it. As the British leg was coming to a close, there was much chatter between the lads as to whether any of us would be fortunate enough to be asked to go into Europe, where a full complement of 22 drivers would be required due to the much larger distances between destinations. When I got the call asking if I was interested in the European leg, I could hardly keep the excitement out of my voice as I replied, "Yes, please." Other than a couple of long weekend breaks, where a few of us flew home, it was 9 solid months of work. It's an experience I wouldn't have missed for the world. From minus 23 degrees wintertime weather in Mannheim, Germany, to getting on for plus 40 in the summertime Rome. Plus the opportunity to visit some of the most iconic cities in Europe. What more could an itinerant traveller want? Spending a week in somewhere like Berlin or Prague and enjoying a bit of sightseeing and local culture, as well as having the opportunity to compare local beers, was well worth its weight in gold. It was akin to an all-expenses year-long holiday around Europe. Something like 30 cities from Lisbon and Madrid in the south, to Oslo and Stockholm in the north, Amsterdam and Rotterdam in the west, to Moscow and Istanbul in the east. It was a ball, and most probably worth a podcast all of its own. However, touring etiquette expects that what goes on tour stays on tour. The only reason us lads on the British leg got offered the work was that a good number of the senior drivers looked upon theatrical tours with a bit of disdain. Rock and roll it certainly wasn't. I didn't care. The opportunity to travel was my beacon. Christmas Day was spent in Paris, performing 3 shows for an enthusiastic audience. At the end of the tour, it was 2 weeks off, then straight onto the rock and roll touring season. Roughly from late February through to early November. Although, as with all things R&R, these dates are very much a flexible feast. My first proper music tour was with the iconic Elton John, on a 3-week jaunt around Europe. Although jaunt doesn't quite cover for the fact that this was not the semi-laid-back progress of theatrical work, but a full-on rocking tour with gig, overnighter, and so on until the tour ended. By that, I mean a performance by the star of the show, followed normally by a long overnight drive to the next performance. Proper music tours may sound a romantic option for the board, but they are definitely not everyone's cup of tea, as they involve an incredible amount of personal commitment and hard graft. If your shift is a normal 4 or 5 o'clock start in the morning, maybe finishing at 6 in the evening, then off home to a nice warm bed, let's stick with that. If you're allocated a full-on rock and roll tour with a young up-and-coming band of youngsters 30 or 40 years younger than yourself, be prepared to be shocked. Their energy levels are going to be double yours, and so they are more than capable of being able to gig and party. The sequence of events goes something like this. Leave base and head for various destinations in the UK to load up the band's equipment. For example, lighting, rigging, sound, plus the multitude of ancillary bits and pieces go to make up the band's pack. Often it is so tightly packed into your trailer that you'd struggle to squeeze a Rizzler in there. Hopefully the band's manager will know the best way to stack the equipment so that it all fits. It's definitely a Tetris thing. If he doesn't, it's best make a note of what goes where. Because if you don't, there ain't going to be much time to learn once the tour proper starts. Once you've collected the last item, it'll be straight off to Dover or similar and heading for your first gig somewhere in Europe. Arriving at the theatre, arena or club where they are performing, mid-morning the following day, after a 10-hour drive, it is straight into loading. That means unloading all the equipment for that night's performance. If you're lucky, you may be able to park outside the venue. Let's assume you are. If there's no catering provided, and with small bands that is highly unlikely, you now have to find yourself breakfast or lunch. Having sweated your bollocks off and loading the gear, it's summertime, and you're desperate for a shower. Not always easy in a backstreet club in a big city. Usually a basin in a washroom in the maze of corridors at the rear of the venue might have to suffice until you can find a truck stop en route to your next function. By now it's mid to late afternoon. The performance starts in 5 or so hours, at 8-ish, and goes on till around 11. You're in the middle of Europe. The temperature's in the mid-30s, and somehow you've got to try and sleep curbside with the constant hubbub of passing traffic and chattering pedestrians. On top of that, you're in a black cab, not ideal in the middle of summer. Sleep is usually very patchy in these scenarios. Normally I'll leave the radio on as it helps me settle. By 10 I have to be up and about and readying the trailer for loadout. These are very often chaotic affairs, with flight boxes and stuff littering the sidewalk, as stage crew and small tour crew dismantle the set and roll it outside. By 11:30, if you're fortunate, you'll be once again sweating like the proverbial pig, but at least loaded and, if very fortunate, invited into the venue to share sandwiches or pizza with the band and crew. It's up to you whether you accept the beer that goes with it. Midnight is off, making your way out through the late-night traffic and onto the nearest autobahn. By 3 in the afternoon, the tour bus with the crew and band on board will be cruising past on its way to the next function, which can be anything up to 150 to 400 miles away. And if it's the latter, you have a good 10 or 11-hour shift ahead of you. Anything further, you might require a double driver being flown out to assist in getting you to the next gig on time. It's a job where you're always up against the legalities of driving hours and rest. This sequence is repeated on every day of the tour, and by end of it, exhaustion will have set in. Fortunately for me, being an old codger, I was normally allocated to what were called the old man's tours. These were tours where there were often 40 or more lorries involved. Not only were a good proportion of the tour drivers getting on in years, so were the band members. Usually rock and roll royalty of some sort, often with their own medical team in attendance. They performed at most 2 or 3 times a week, which also allowed us old lorry driving farts a bit of a break between gigs as well. Until I was forced to retire at the age of 71 in 2017, I managed over 30 tours, 3 of which were theatrical, Walking with Dinosaurs twice and Batman once, as well as supporting some of the most iconic bands in the world, The Stones, AC/DC, U2, and Beyonce, to name a few. And I can say, hand on heart, that the hard work that some of it was, with boxes of Swan Bestus matches and cans of Red Bull required to keep the eyelids from closing up, I loved every moment of it. When the DVLA informed me after my annual medical that due to my peripheral vision not meeting the standards required to drive an HGV, they were going to rescind my license, I was distraught. I have to say it was one of the worst days of my life, made even worse by the fact that the day previously I had received a letter from them saying that I had met all the requirements to continue driving. I can honestly say that over a period of 30, 50 years, I've been a very fortunate individual as far as my driving career is concerned. It has been during what many consider to have been the golden era of road transport, the era where for a Brit looking for a bit of an adventure, everything was possible. The era where, once away from your depot, your boss had to trust you to get the job completed successfully. The phone or phone or telex went empty era. Now, like the rest of Western Europe, our indigenous haulage industry has taken a beating from the influx of behemoth-sized companies from Eastern Europe. Something none of us who drove those countries prior to the dissolution of communism could ever have believed possible. But a guy called Reinus Reinhardt, a well-known and respected Dutch hauler, called it right in the late 1990s when he said, "There is a storm building from the east that is going to decimate European haulage as we know it. The winds of change blowing through the transport industry that started as a gentle breeze in the early 90s is now a squall, and I am sure before many more years have passed will be a full-blown hurricane. Companies like Link and Wabra, who we affectionately call the Sunshine Boys due to their eye-catching logo, have grabbed the capitalist ideal by the throat and are starting to eat into the European business model like a lion devouring its prey. This new breed of super hauliers with their vast fleets of trucks are going to change the map of European transport forever." Well said, say I. What I also noticed as the former countries of the communist bloc joined the European Union was the vast amount of EU money being invested in their infrastructure, especially Poland. In the 25 years since Poland applied for membership, they have constructed in excess of 2,000 miles of new motorway, while we in Britain have built no new motorways other than widening or upgrading a few dual carriageways to motorway spec. While our infrastructure is disintegrating before our very eyes, it seems as if the rest of Europe is getting a makeover. I don't feel sorry for the young lads and lasses now making their way in today's more sanitised and controlled road haulage industry, because as we knew nothing about the industry that preceded our time on the road, neither do they know much about our time in the business. As I say to my sons, all you know is what you know. You can't learn from my experiences. You'll have to make your own. And with that, good luck, guys and gals.
Well, I think that was great. Thank you, Paul.
Was it okay to share?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Well, I hope everyone else has enjoyed it as well. And that's the end of part two, and that's Paul's life story. So that's Paul's life story, yeah.
A potted history of transport of the last 50 years.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd love to hear any feedback from what you think of it all. But yeah, thanks for listening, and hope to talk to you soon.
Thank you for tuning in to the Truck and Driver podcast, proudly sponsored by TomTom. As a special thanks to our listeners for trucking through the holiday season, we're giving away 1 month free of TomTom Go Navigation Truck. Simply download the Go Navigation app and use the code TRUCKYEAH. That's TRUCKYEAH when subscribing. Safe travels, folks.